comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.
Well, it's every other Sunday again, and welcome to Sustainability Now. I'm not sure that's the right theme to begin the program with today, but we're having a conversation about PG&E and renewable energy. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and today my guest is Professor Dustin Mulvaney from the Environmental Studies Department at San Jose State University. His research focuses on social and environmental dimensions of food and energy systems, innovation, emerging technologies, and environmental change. He's author of Solar Power, Innovation, Sustainability, and Environmental Justice, and the forthcoming Sustainable Energy Strategies, Socio-Ecological Dimensions of Decarbonization. Today we're going to talk about what do we do with a problem like PG&E. We're going to have a conversation about electrical utilities, how they operate, who regulates them and doesn't regulate them, and the future of PG&E and various alternatives. Well, let's get started with the show. Welcome, Dustin. I'm glad you could be here on this rainy day.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with having you tell us about your background, what you do, and how you got into this business.
Well, as you described, I'm a professor at San Jose State. And before that, I spent some time at UC Berkeley doing a postdoc. And before that, I was a graduate student at UC Santa Cruz, where I first met you. And going back in time before that, my first degree was in chemical engineering, and I worked in the chemical industry a little while before going back to graduate school. And I've always been interested in questions around technology and environmental change, and the opportunity presented itself for me to go to graduate school, and that's how I got on this pathway. But I've done a lot of consulting also around energy systems in addition to my academic job, so that's how I've come into contact with PG&E most frequently.
Yeah, so you've done testimony at various kinds of hearings about PG&E, right?
That's correct, yeah.
Just tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I've worked primarily for the Sierra Club and Earth Justice before the Public Utilities Commission. So because PG&E is a regulated monopoly, when they change their electricity rates, they have to go before the Public Utilities Commission to get those approved. And one thing that we'll do, Sierra Club, will hire an analyst like myself to say, okay, if we change the electricity rates, how does it affect the price of an investment in solar? Does it make it more attractive for people to go solar or not? Same with energy efficiency investments and things. Because if they make electricity too cheap for certain ratepayers, it then doesn't pencil out for them to go solar or invest in energy efficiency.
You know, I'm sure there's a question in everybody's mind, which is, how did we end up with this particular utility system in Northern California? You know, what's the history of PG&E and private utilities more generally?
Well, utilities are a special kind of business because they're thought of as having a natural monopoly, meaning we don't want to have multiple telephone poles running electricity wires competing against each other. So usually the state grants a natural monopoly to an entity that provides natural gas or electricity, and PG&E is just a merger of a whole bunch of previous gas and electric companies that were much smaller, but that's how we're left with really three investor-owned utilities in the state: PG&E, SoCal Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric.
But there are also private public utilities, right?
There are smaller public utilities, correct. And usually the legacy, these are historical artifacts, usually whether a utility is public or private. In some cases, a private utility or investor-owned utility has existed and some part of that utility has broken away to become a smaller publicly mm-hmm. held ones. But in other parts of the country, there were no investors to invest in public infrastructure. So like the Tennessee Valley Authority is a publicly held utility, but they don't have the same kind of progressive policies you'd see in California in terms of renewable energy adoption and such. So necessarily the public versus private is a historical artifact as much as anything else.
The whole idea of regulation began during the great era of the great trusts back at the beginning of the 20th century.
That's right, yep.
When private companies were buying up bankrupt small ones to consolidate and essentially establish monopoly positions, right?
Yep,
so the progressives across the country imposed state regulations so that these monopolies would be allowed to operate without gouging the public.
Yeah, and it's funny because if you look at the titles of a lot of those companies, they were consolidated so-and-so gas and electric company. It was like literally in the titles of the companies.
So how well did this regulation work? I mean, how did it work during the 20th century?
Well, there's a couple of different businesses in electricity, right? So you have people generating power, you have people transmitting it from the generators to where it's going to be distributed, and then you have distribution, and then you have retailing. So you really have four segments. And historically, all four of those things would happen by the same company. They would generate the electricity, and they would market it to customers and deliver it all the way to them. And then we decided that markets would be better solution for what would otherwise be a captive customer base with a monopoly. So they thought maybe utilities were doing things that were not necessarily disingenuous, meaning they would cost electricity too much, make electricity prices go up too much. So in the late 90s, really, there was a conversation about breaking up the utilities into these different businesses. And they made, for example, PG&E sell off all of its power plants. So it became kind of a more of a transmission and delivery and retail entity than a generator base as it had in the past.
Yeah, except for Diablo Canyon and the hydro power
That's
facilities,
correct.
Right?
Certain
the most
unique,
expensive and the cheapest, right?
Certain unique assets that could not be sold to other entities, yes.
Yeah. Yep. One of the things that I remember, I didn't know this, but you know, as a kid, was that electricity was the energy source of the future, that everything would be all electric. Where have you heard that one, folks? Right, because electricity would just get cheaper and cheaper.
That's right.
And as the nuclear folks promised us, it would be too cheap to meter.
That's right.
So so the idea was that utilities would just sell more and more electricity, right? And but in order to keep them from making super profits,
that's right. Yeah.
They were only allowed a certain return every time they came back to the Public Utilities Commission. And this was based on, you know, their plant, the facilities they had built, and a certain amount of money. But
that's right.
But then in California, we had this situation where electricity started to get really expensive,
right,
especially once Diablo Canyon started operating. And I don't remember exactly when that was. Do you?
Diablo Canyon comes on in the 80s.
In the 80s.
In the
oh, was that long ago?
Yeah. No, it's coming on. I'm not sure there's a direct connection with Diablo Canyon necessarily in PG&E's prices, although it's been a very expensive power plant to operate. And, you know, it turns out that it's cheaper to spend a lot of money to close it than it is to keep it running long term because of the once through cooling system, which basically entrains a lot of marine wildlife. So same issue we have up here in Monterey Bay with Moss Landing. There's an interesting moment, though, in the time period you're talking about, where there's two kind of we talk about this energy deregulation as this thing. Energy deregulation is basically when we wanted to start splitting apart the generators from the people who transmit it. Meaning, if PG&E did both the generation and the transmission and distribution, maybe it'd be cheaper if we let the market actually figure out cheaper generators and get more power plants from what we call merchant power plants involved. The other thing that happens alongside that in parallel, and often why it gets it's confusing to talk about energy deregulation, is this decoupling thing, which you described before, which is decoupling the profits from sales of electricity from the business model, essentially. Because right now you have a business model where electricity is generated and sold, and it's not necessarily in the investor-owned utility's best interest to sell less of it unless there's actually a reward given to them. So decoupling essentially let PG&E sell electricity and make a return when they got people to consume less, or at least kept it steady and made it more easy.
That was the theory.
That was the theory, yeah. Exactly. No, that was not how it played out.
We'll come back to the theory in a few minutes. We're going to take a break. You're listening to KSQD in Santa Cruz and KSQD .org online. That's 90.7 FM. And Jill and I are going to now.
Well, we'll just be right back after a brief message.
KSQD thanks Sustainable Systems Research Foundation for supporting Sustainability Now. SSRF provides education, research, and advocacy for regional environmental quality and sustainability-related problems and solutions. For information, visit sustainablesystemsfoundation.org. And thank you, SSRF, for supporting community radio, K-Squid, 90.7 FM.
Well, this is Sustainability Now, and my guest today is Dustin Mulvaney, professor of environmental studies at San Jose State University. And we're talking about what do we do with a problem like PG&E. When we left you, we were talking about the great regulatory meltdown of 2000 and why that happened and what it left us. As I recall, the theory was that the market, the free market, would basically push electric generators, people with, you know, companies with electric generators, to compete to offer the lowest price to the utility. I mean, that was the theory, that's right? The in theory, competition, right. They would push the price down.
Right.
But what happened was, because of the way in which utilities require electricity, because of the, you know, differing, the changing demand over the course of the day, mm-hmm. Some of the generators started gaming the system.
That's right. Yep.
And running up costs to an unconscionable level.
Yeah.
And San Diego had no choice but to San Diego Gas and Electric, as I recall, had to pay that, and the price, the retail price of electricity skyrocketed.
That's
and
this, right.
And this is when those famous California brownouts took place. It wasn't an energy crisis; it was a market crisis.
There were blackouts. They weren't just brownouts. They were actual blackouts, and they affected actually as many customers as were affected by this recent blackouts that we've had over the last couple months with the fire safety precautions. So there we have, energy deregulation means a lot of different things, and that's, I think, one thing we have to be clear about, because some of the early energy deregulationing, allowing a rooftop solar customer to suddenly dump its electricity into the grid, that's a good move in the energy deregulation space by opening the market up to competition. So in that sense, it has worked. And earlier I described decoupling and letting PG&E profit being able to profit without having to sell more electricity. I mean, that's the challenge with the system. You have a fixed amount of generators in the system, and you can't just let, you don't have an infinite amount of resources here. So that has allowed PG&E to set up some pretty good rebate programs, for example, for energy efficient appliances in the Pacific Energy Center in San Francisco, which has a lending library. So in some ways, some aspects of energy deregulation have been pretty beneficial. The particular moment that you're describing, which involved Enron and them scheduling power plants, doing maintenance, quote unquote, and actually that just restricted the amount of power that was being generated, and they were swapping power back and forth over the states. So wheeling power around in different markets and marking it up every time they had a transaction. And that really caused a lot of economic damage. And, you know, some of those challenges that came out of there, Gray Davis ended up signing some very long-term contracts that were actually very, very high priced. The prices came down pretty shortly thereafter, but California got locked in for 10 years at really high prices for a while. So that experiment of energy deregulation, some would call it a partial deregulation, because even though the generator cost is the cost that PG&E was paying for electricity from power plants was skyrocketing, what PG&E could pass through to us was capped as customers, and that's where they went bankrupt, right? Because they weren't allowed to pass on those costs to their customer base. So that had left a pretty big mark, I think, on the state's experiment, and maybe has influenced others to come up with new rules to make sure those kinds of things don't happen, or go the opposite way, which is to have these things be publicly owned.
Well, it leads to two questions. Let's see if I can keep them in mind. The first one is, what does PG&E get rate increases on the basis of these days? If it's not, you know, selling more electricity, building more plants, increasing its the value of its, you know, setup. How do they get rate increases?
Well, you mean electricity rate increases?
Electricity, yeah. We're not talking about gas right
now.
Well,
electricity rate increases would be something that gets approved that helps pay for the system.
Mm-hmm.
That really shouldn't affect their profitability. I think the bigger question is how are these, how, Well, go ahead. I'll let you.
No. So the rate increases are to address increased costs of operation.
Correct.
Right?
That's right.
And then there's a fixed return on top of
that's
that.
Correct.
Is that how
that's,
it works?
That's how the monopoly works.
Okay,
in
so
California.
That's how it works. And what's the fixed return these days? Do you know?
12%. Someone will have to Google that to which correct it, but it's,
which isn't bad if you're
it's pretty darn good if you're talking tens of billions of dollars of value, although that value's not there right now, and that's where this problem is really thorny now with the current bankruptcy issues. The value's not there.
Yeah. How do utilities buy electricity now? I'm thinking about through the ISO and the bidding process.
Right. They buy electricity through different markets. One is, like, for example, the day-ahead market. They'll schedule certain power plants with renewables. They have, because we have a renewable portfolio standard, which requires the utilities to buy an increasing amount of electricity every year, those are usually long-term contracts. So it's actually pretty messy how electricity is contracted for. And that's part of the complication. So some of it's bought on spot market, like who's available now and what are they selling for, and some of it's contracted long term. So the process is very muddy. There's not a clear cut process because different entities get to play in the market different ways.
Mm-hmm. How long are these contracts? These renewable contracts? How long do they run now?
They're getting shorter and shorter because the buyer gets to rule the roost, right? Mm-hmm. So it used to be we see power purchase agreements for 25 years, and now I've seen some for 5 years. So they're getting shorter and shorter. And that's the other part of this deregulation story, which is that the retail has been deregulated. So that's why we have all these community choice aggregators, because they are now allowed to compete on the retail sale of electricity, even with PG&E remaining the transmission and distribution part of the backbone of the grid.
Yeah, I want to come back to those a little bit later.
Sure.
Okay. All right, so PG&E only generates electricity from Diablo Canyon and from the hydro facilities nowadays, right? And then
you don't have a full catalog, but that sounds right. There might be some other assets they were not able to.
Spin out. And then they buy from whatever's available in the market from whoever's generating it,
right? Or whatever long-term contracts they've committed to from, for example, solar farms.
Yeah. Do they get a lot? Does PG&E get a lot of power from out of state at this point?
PG&E does, yeah. And the whole all of California gets a large portion.
Do you have any idea how much that is?
30%.
And where does it come from?
Everywhere. Across the West. For example,
Con Edison is not sending it to us.
Great reporter at the LA Times, Sammy Roth, wrote a really nice piece recently about a coal-fired power plant that's being kept alive in Utah by the ratepayers of LADWP. And there's a case where it's a publicly owned utility. So that's why the ownership structure isn't necessarily the panacea here. It's about accountability. And I think in California, one of the experiments that isn't highlighted enough is that we have a very open stakeholder process, meaning Sierra Club, for example, could hire me to contest with the consultants that PG&E is hired to say what the outcomes would be. And that all gets paid for by the shareholders. That's a very good accountability model that I almost don't think it matters whether it's public or private. There are other reasons to go public or private, and we could talk about those, but it's more about accountability, because we can go find public utilities that are horribly run, unaccountable, black box institutions that are impenetrable to change. So for me, it's the governance structure over whatever the entity is. Now, again, there are reasons to have a publicly owned entity. I think that, you know, putting profit second or third might be one good reason to do that. But there are other reasons as well. Shareholding, prioritizing wildfire safety might be one good one that we all should be talking about.
How often in these regulatory hearings does PG&E not get its way?
It's very disconcerting sometimes the level of engagement they actually have. So I will be hired, for example, to look at what the impacts of a rate change would have on solar adoption. And they basically don't come back with anything. They'll come back attacking my credibility and, like, say, oh, why aren't you the Stanford professor instead of the San Jose State professor? Like, they want different, like, they basically will kind of just
do personal assassination.
They'll basically try to undermine credibility.
Yeah.
And we've been very lucky. I mean, we make such solid cases. So there's a principle, and this is really important. So it's called cost causality. What's been happening is electric utilities around the nation have been wanting to put a fee on rooftop solar customers because they're saying the rooftop solar customers are freeloading off of the grid. They're not paying for the grid.
Right, yeah.
And there's a principle in rate making, and the Public Utilities Commission is beholden to this to some extent, which is cost causality. And if I can't, if the utility can't prove a solar customer is costing extra money, they can't charge them a fee for being hooked up to the grid unless they could prove that. And we'll show a model and we'll say, hey, look, all those rooftop customers are actually saving the total utility money because we're not burning all these natural gas power plants that are super inefficient. So in that case, if we can say that the ratepayers benefit from these solar customers, they can't charge these things. So no matter, and that's why PG&E, when their level of engagement is not really there, because if they don't have the evidence to prove their point, They just walk away and they do character assassination and try to go that route.
Let's come back to that in a few minutes. We're going to take a break. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM and KSQD.org on the internet. Your ink spot on the radio dial. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz and my guest today is Dustin Mulvaney, Professor of Environmental Studies at San Jose State University. We're talking about PG&E. What do we do with a problem like PG&E? And remind me where we were, what we were talking. We were talking about, I know, regulation and character assassination and basically
energy modeling.
Basically PG&E not putting up a case.
Yeah.
Well, you know, from reading the San Francisco Chronicle for, what, now 30 years, I sort of got the impression that the PUC, at least under its former chair, basically did whatever PG&E wanted it to. So I was sort of fishing for that.
Let's talk about that. Okay,
yeah.
So I have recently been spending a bit of time looking at wildfire issues. Obviously, my students are asking about wildfire in the state, which is the reason we have a PG&E bankruptcy crisis right now, is there's all these liabilities. And that's one of the challenges. If we wanted to have a publicly owned PG&E, we got to pick up these liabilities in the future. And I'm not sure that that's a good public debt to incur. Now, going back, I found this very interesting. So the beauty of this system in California, where you have what we call the docket, and the docket is where all the documents live, where PG&E wants to change things, Southern California Edison wants to change things, and ratepayer advocates have a voice and NGOs. And I went back and looked. 2007, there's a fire called the Witch Fire. And the Witch Fire, basically, big fire in San Diego Gas and Electric territory, it spurred a bunch of hearings at the CPUC on whether the CPUC has the authority to regulate transmission lines. Now, remember, these two big fires recently, two of them have been from 90 and 100-year-old transmission towers with brittle steel breaking apart, and that's part of the question here is, was PG&E paying for the upkeep and maintenance of these transmission towers? So they basically, at the time, PG&E would say this is the FERC's responsibility. They would say the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is a D.C.-based agency that regulates interstate movement of electricity, it's their jurisdiction, the transmission towers. So I think that people saying it's CPUC's fault for not holding PG&E accountable, I think that that's actually a misread of the history. Because if you read through the docket, you can find evidence where PG&E is saying, oh, we shouldn't have the same inspection regime as San Diego Gas and Electric because the fire regime is different. Now, we see catastrophic fires now in Northern California that, you know, make that kind of a moot point. So they were fighting even the jurisdiction of CPUC in this area, creating that crisis of jurisdiction you often see where, someone says, they're the ones who regulate us. They're the favorable ones. We want them to regulate us. They don't actually do anything to us, so let's keep them in charge, not put you in charge. And that's basically what we saw, was a lot of pushback. It's literally in the testimony, basically says CPUC shall not regulate our transmission towers because that's a federal domain. So the CPUC was also headed by the former president of SoCal Edison for 10 years. So there's disingenuity going across everywhere here. But to say that it's the regulator's fault sounds like a familiar riff, basically, in all environmental history to some extent.
Yeah, but just for those of you who are nerds about this, the technical term for finding the most favorable place to get rulings is called forum shopping.
Sure, right.
Right?
Yeah, political science.
Just
yeah.
in political science, yeah. right? So yeah. just remember that one.
Geographers call that a crisis of jurisdiction because they think about space, but that's fair.
Well, you know, it's capitalism, so forum shopping makes much more sense. What happened with that argument? Did FERC ever step in to do any kind of regulation?
You know what happened? San Bruno blew up. I think that what happened at San Bruno when you had all these pipelines, suddenly the public empowered the California Public Utilities Commission to say, hey, guess what? You guys are in charge of safety around here. Don't let PG&E point to DC and say they're in charge of safety. Like, you have the authority to do something about this. And, you know, these are positions that are appointed by the governor at the end of the day. So, like, these are very political agencies in the sense that they're very aware of when they have political power and when they don't. And it seemed to me, reading through that witch fire, which I'm sure people in San Diego are reading about, not the whole state was not reading about it, not like we're seeing today with all the coverage with PG&E stories every single day. So I think San Bruno's explosions and the clear negligence of PG&E in that case, like criminal negligence in that case. Unfortunately, no one went to jail, and you can't put a company in jail, but people should have gone to jail for that explosion. I don't know who. I don't know where. I mean, that's the problem with some of these thorny, knotty problems, is it's hard to find specific people to point at. But
yeah, corporations are legal persons, but no corporation has ever gone to jail.
That's correct. Yes. Yes.
But I mean, then this gets to the point about the cost of, you know, refurbishing the transmission system is astronomical. I don't know. It's in the multiple tens of billions.
Right?
We have no idea what that's going to be. And if PG&E were required to put these things underground, that would multiply it by a factor of at least 3 or 4, I suppose.
It could, but we're balancing that against these liabilities, right?
Right.
That's the thing. So if we look at since the witch fire in 2007, San Diego Gas and Electric, who was held to a stricter standard than PG&E and fire oversight, has undergrounded something like 40% of their lines.
Any idea what it cost?
I don't know, but I don't hear people in San Diego screaming about their electricity prices. So they've figured out a way to figure out where the cheapest places to underground are, where the riskiest places are. And they've been doing power shutoffs longer there. So it's very different, but it's all to say that a lot of the destiny here is in control of, you know, making sure that there's oversight on these entities.
Yeah,
the wildfire issue is much, much bigger than just PG&E,
and that
has to do with zoning. I mean, more than half of these houses are burning in the last couple of years have burned in urban areas, not the wildland urban interface. So that's changing the game. We have 40% of the fires, I think, in Santa Rosa. Houses burned from the inside out. And people are talking about climate change.
How did that happen?
Because in these fires, you basically have a blizzard of embers, and you have houses that are built in the 50s that have open attics, and like, all it takes a couple of embers and the house catches on fire. So you have a building code problem. I mean, this is where this gets really messy now, because now we have a bankrupt entity.
Right.
We have houses that are vulnerable to fire. Mm-hmm. We have zoning problems out the wazoo with residential seas of residential houses everywhere, and like, houses that have more plastic, they burn hotter. I mean, houses, think of all the carpet and all the stuff inside of houses. Like, you look at these aerial photographs of these fires and you see the tree crowns are all green. And it's like, that fire didn't burn that intensely. It's an ignition problem. It's the houses are igniting. And that's
just
not
very
a climate.
Flammable. Mm-hmm.
And I totally agree with the climate change moment that this is bringing up, but I also get frustrated by it because that's not the immediate solution. The immediate solution is fixing these houses that are self-igniting.
But if you had one house burning down in Santa Rosa, it would not ignite, you know, 500 others, right?
Sure, but if it's an urban area, it will.
The question is, do the homes in the peripheral area they're burning down contribute then further to the movement, the embers and everything, right?
That's a question.
So you know, in a sense, it's people living in the wrong place, right? You might say
that's part of it, but they've been living there for a long time. Some of these places that are, you know, some of these places have lower populations than they had 100 years ago because there's less agriculture, there's less.
Yeah,
so it depends.
But things were worth a lot less 100 years ago.
That's a whole other layer.
Let's talk about, you know, we want to talk about politics and political influence.
Well, that's why one of these solutions, just to riff off that for a second, the solution where we talk about solar and batteries and microgrids and chopping the wire actually becomes cost competitive. Around the nation, you'll hear people saying, oh, solar and storage is so expensive.
No,
you know what's expensive? A California home's expensive. Yeah. Rent's expensive.
Yeah.
Like the cost of solar and storage in that context is actually not very much. It's granite countertops or solar on the roof. What do you want with your new house?
Yeah, I want to come back and talk about that because, But so PG&E's in bankruptcy.
Right.
And they're talk about, you know, municipalization, state takeovers, what's his name coming in with his Berkshire Hathaway. Right. Warren Buffett coming
Correct,
in.
Correct. Yeah.
And buying PG&E. God knows why.
He owns every other utility across the West. That's why.
Is it really?
He owns Rocky Mountain Power. He owns PacifiCorp. So he owns NV Energy. He owns the whole Western United States electricity grid. And he owns a company that makes utility scale solar farms, and all their utilities fight against rooftop solar. So there you go. Now you can see why I know that guy.
Yeah.
So, I don't know him personally, by the way. I knew of him. His fame.
What do you think is the future of PG&E?
I don't know. I think that I really wish that there would be a genuine conversation. And my experience with PG&E in the past, it's just they're just going to do everything they can to protect the existing business structure and shareholders.
Of course, yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, there's a couple of visions. You could see them splitting the gas company from the electric company, and that's problematic for some reasons, because then you'll suddenly have a natural gas lobby fighting for their existence. So in some ways it's nice to have PG&E electric having the electric side and the gas side, because at least in the electrification movement, PG&E is not trying to squash that to keep their natural gas alive. But if they're a separate company, they might stay alive. They might try to keep their interests alive. So we see that right now with SoCalGas. I'm in a testimony against them right now, and they're just fighting everything they can to keep their company alive.
You think private utilities are doomed?
I don't know. I think that's a very geographic question. I think there are certain parts of the country where private companies are going to do fine because it's part of the culture there. I mean, Texas, there's not going to be. I can't imagine Texas.
Well, you know, the argument that was made a few years
California,
ago.
Maybe.
The argument that was made some years ago was that as people disconnect from the grid, or as they start to become more reliant on local sources, that the utilities are going to go into a downward spiral. Because, you know, they're going to sell less, and they're going to have to charge more, and eventually, right, this whole logic drives to a different form of organization.
That's right.
Which we'll spend the last quarter of an hour talking about community aggregation and these alternatives. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you're listening to Sustainability Now. My guest today is Dustin Mulvaney, professor of environmental studies at San Jose State University. And we are talking about what do we do with a problem like PG&E. So, Dustin, you mentioned earlier that looking at a much more localized power generation strategy might actually end up costing less than maintaining the PG&E or the big monopoly utilities.
I'm not sure we know that for certain, but you could certainly see a scenario where it makes more sense to deliver electricity to certain communities in a way that is much less expensive and is much, much closer. So I definitely think that there are areas right now, for example, that is that's expensive to service for PG&E, that they might be remote, they might be on a corridor that's just happens to be very congested, something like that. So I don't know if we know the answer. I don't think we have the empirics to say either way, but you could certainly envision that it could be cheaper in certain ways.
One of course, the question is, you know, what is the cost to the customer, right? You mentioned that the relative cost of the cost of solar relative to the value of the house in California is pretty small, $10,000-$20,000 on a million-dollar house or something like that. So you know, there's that question. Of course, people are house rich, cash poor in California as well. They're stuck in their houses because they can't afford to move anywhere. But this point about looking at more remote locations or locations on peripheries, right?
Correct.
And looking at the logic of building microgrids.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Sounds like a strategy or something that we should be experimenting with.
That's correct. Yeah, and I think that this is again where that PG&E is a complex organization. I think we can bemoan the fact that they're always protecting their shareholders in certain respects, but it is a complicated organization. Like I said, there are people working on energy efficiency. There are people who are working on microgrids at PG&E. And we see experiments with PG&E, for example, trying to island areas of an island, meaning like separate out from the electricity grid areas of Humboldt County, for example, as an experiment. Now, they are test bedding these things. They're not doing it to allow these parts of the grid to separate. It's actually pretty complicated, I think, to get legally to be able to divorce yourself from the electric utility.
I read something a few weeks ago that PG&E was setting up so-called microgrids in Sonoma County. They were bringing in large generators, but these are natural gas generators, right?
Probably. I think, right? Or diesel or gasoline.
Well, yeah, in which case they're very dirty.
That's correct, yeah.
And not very efficient at all. Yeah.
Right. But, I mean, this is why it's complicated to answer this question, which is that what is the cost of future wildfire liabilities?
Yeah.
We don't know that answer, and we don't know how to actually help pay for that. Where could we make that happen? For example, could we have a program where – so we have a law rolling out next year. All new houses need to have solar on them. That's the solar rooftop mandate. And a lot of people complained about it, said, oh, it's so expensive to put solar on the roof. We should just do it in big solar farms. But you can imagine taking a step further and saying, you know, we shouldn't just have houses that have solar on top. We should have houses that actually could – also store some of that energy and have the capacity to island themselves. So I think that it has to be part of the solution, because right now we have an electricity system with hot wires over very dry landscapes, and it's always going to cause problems. Whether we can come up with solutions for it or not, it's just going to be expensive to fix. And you know, I think that the ability to isolate and not have some of these wires running during these impactful events could help, I think, reduce the future cost of wildfires. We know that, because that's why they're doing the shutoffs. Now the question is, how can you have these shutoffs and still have these communities with their lights on? That's the model.
Yeah.
But I think you asked earlier, what are the different organizational outcomes of this reorganization? And that's why I think having everything on the table makes sense, because maybe these should be — right now we have these things called community choice aggregators.
Yeah, let's talk about those.
Which I know that's basically the deregulation of the retail market. These folks are now able to say they're procuring certain electricity and delivering it to a customer and giving retail choice to people who in Santa Cruz, for example, I can say I want to be part of my CCA, not PG&E, and I'm going to pay them, and they're going to get their electricity from X, Y, and Z solar farms and these wind farms. But that's still not necessarily delivering all the electricity, right? And I think the ultimate goal is actually locally owned generation, transmission, distribution, and retailing. I mean, all that having all that fall under one domain is important, because people have asked me many times, should we make PG&E a public utility? And I said, that's a question we should have asked 30 years ago before we had market deregulation, because now we can make PG&E a public utility, but all the power plants are private now. So the public utility would then be held to all these merchant generators who can charge whatever and aren't — I mean, they're accountable through the structures I talked about before, but it doesn't necessarily give you the outcome. Yeah. Now, 30 years ago, if we made PG&E a public utility, then you're making the power plants and the wires publicly owned. Mm-hmm. And that's a different formula. So I feel like if we were to make the wires public, it's still problematic because the generators are private. And that makes the wires captive to the generators. And that's a situation that it could be tenable, but I'm not sure that it's very easy to work through.
Do CCAs have the right to generate their own electricity?
I would imagine so, but I do not know the answer to that.
I've been under the impression that that's part of the
deal. They're allowed to do whatever. They're allowed to put whatever restrictions they want, I believe, like any filter they want. For example, I saw a talk by Marin's CCA, and they're trying to do more locally generate. They're not going to contract with solar farms that are in the Mojave Desert. They want to more locally contract.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they have some with farther afield solar farms. But I think that that's the general principle, that they could buy whatever they want from whoever they want. And local could be a filter on that.
Yeah.
But again, it's still... Again, we have a lot of private power being generated in the state, and none of that would be public if we made PG&E public. We'd still have a bunch of private generators running natural gas plants out, trying to get them sold, trying to get the utilities to buy them. So,
yeah, well, I mean, one of the visions is CCAs as being essentially fairly autonomous units, connected to each other,
right,
but no longer beholden to the
right,
massive transmission system. You know, what happens then to the private generators? You know, if they don't have customers.
They disappear.
They disappear.
They have to. There's nowhere else to go.
I suppose they could ship it over to Nevada or
someplace.
They can
make desalinated water with their natural gas plant and ship it somewhere maybe. I'm not sure. I mean, yeah, we're talking about, it's a complicated electricity system. So, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure there. There's a lot of time that's been invested in this stuff. But I think for CCAs to do more meaningful work, they do have to start thinking about a model that incorporates the wires and the generation. Because right now it's only retail choice, and I don't think people quite get that. Like you can have a CCA that's powered by 100% renewables, and you look at their list and they're buying all solar. That is not a recipe for keeping your lights on in the real world, because the sun goes down.
Yeah.
So, like, if we actually want to be delivering renewable power to these smaller CCAs or whatever the organizational structure is, you have to literally do it. And we're starting to see that. Like, for example, with Google now trying to buy power hourly instead of saying, hey, here's all the – we bought all this renewable electricity through RECs, or in some cases it's real power. But again, you could look at a company that claims to be powered by 100% renewables and look at their list, and it's all solar farms. You're like, how is that possible? They're not all powered by renewables, because the sun's only up part of the day. So contracting on the hourly basis with real available electricity is kind of the path that has to take. It has to have a material, physical form.
Yeah, it came up a few shows ago, the whole sort of fiction of wheeling power through the grid, right? Pretending that the electrons, you've bought electrons directly from some other place, right? But when it gets mixed up with nighttime electrons, right? And it can't be solar, basically.
Well, for me, I mean, wheeling power is the materiality. That's actually wheeling the power around.
No,
so that's okay. But if you
understand, but it's the fiction of, you know,
exactly,
right? Where it's coming from and how it's, you know, it's all renewable even at midnight,
precisely,
right? Whereas as it's actually...
Yeah.
You know, whatever is in the grid, right?
When you actually have, I mean, this is the challenge we're up against. You actually have parts of the electricity grid today in California in some of those CCA areas that if the natural gas was if the natural gas was turned off in some of these areas, the power would go off.
Yeah.
So, like, how could this county be powered 100% with renewables when actually we have power generators in the county that have to be on for the lights to stay on? So there's a little bit of a shell game. I think that their CCAs are good because they're a leverage. They're a procurement leverage. They're a way to say, hey, we need more solar added to the grid.
Mm-hmm.
But we're getting to the point now where we got to figure out how to assemble it all, not just get more of it.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge that we're facing.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you so much, Dustin, for appearing on the show.
Thank you for having me.
In a couple of weeks, on December 16th, I'm hosting several activists from the Monterey and Santa Cruz chapters of Extinction Rebellion. XR defines itself as a nonviolent rebellion against the U.S. government for its criminal inaction on the ecological crisis. So we're going to be discussing XR's activities and demands and the challenge of making change in the face of climate change.
community.
All right. Thanks very much. And until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Here comes the sun, and I say, it's all right.